Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. After a contentious confirmation hearing and a near party line vote, Congresswoman Deb Haaland is likely going to be confirmed to lead the Department of the Interior, making her the first indigenous person to lead a cabinet agency. She's a member of the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico.
This historic nature of my confirmation is not lost on me, but I will say it's not about me. Rather, I hope this nomination would be an inspiration for Americans moving forward together as one nation and creating opportunities for all of us.
That was the Congresswoman at her confirmation hearing in February. As secretary, she would oversee more than 480 million acres of public lands and nearly a dozen federal agencies, including the National Park Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Later, we'll talk about how historic this nomination is, but first, what might this mean on a policy level? Joining us now is Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. Coral, welcome back to 1A.
Hi, great to be with you.
So where does Deb Haaland's nomination stand right now?
Well, so last week she cleared the Senate Energy Committee, which had to vote to send her to the Senate floor. As you mentioned, that was a very narrow party line vote. It's now expected that next week the full Senate will take up that confirmation vote. Just this morning, the Republican senator from Montana, Senator Daines, announced that he is going to place a hold on her confirmation on that vote. That doesn't mean that the vote can't go forward. It does mean that the Senate will be obliged to take a procedural vote called a cloture vote in order to bring that confirmation to the floor, which necessarily means that there will also be a Senate floor debate. So it could take a little bit longer. But right now, I know that the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer hopes to have that final vote and have her confirmed at some point by the end of next week.
Did he explain his reasoning behind that move?
Yeah, Senator Daines has been a fierce opponent of Deb Haaland's nomination. He, like many Republicans, has said, has acknowledged the historic nature of her nomination. Of course, if confirmed, as you said, she would be the first Native American to become a cabinet secretary. That is a profoundly important step in U.S. history, and Senator Daines has acknowledged that. But like many other Republicans, particularly from states that have a lot of public lands with oil and gas drilling, he has taken fierce objection to Congresswoman Haaland's record as an environmental activist on the issue of oil and gas. She has gone further and made remarks and taken part in protests and demonstrations and petitions and advocacy, organizing for advocacy environmental groups that have gone a lot further than what President Biden has proposed. She has called in her role as an environmental activist for a complete ban on drilling and fracking on public lands. She has been a fierce opponent of the oil and gas industry as a whole. And so that is something that has really, sort of brought a lot of Republicans together in fierce opposition to her, far stronger opposition than to those of other Biden nominees. And so that is the reason for Senator Daines' concern. He says he feels that, as a cabinet secretary, even though Congresswoman Haaland says as secretary, she would sort of enact the presidential agenda, the Biden agenda, he said he fears that she will bring with her this background of advocacy and of opposition to the oil and gas industry. And that's the reason for the hold.
How did Haaland end up becoming President Biden's nominee?
Such an interesting story. She was not really, during the campaign, as the campaign was sort of, you know, last summer and early fall, getting closer to the election, and the Biden team was considering potential cabinet heads, she wasn't really looked at as being on the very short list. For the role of Interior Secretary, the person who was sort of seen as a very natural fit, and that President now President Biden had been thinking about and talking to, was now former Senator Tom Udall, also like Deb Haaland from New Mexico. Tom Udall was someone who had worked on public lands issues and conservation and endangered species issues for years. He had pursued a very similar policy agenda to President Biden, kind of, you know, slowing down oil and gas development on public lands, and was also someone who had a very, very long history of friendship with Joe Biden. I think Tom Udall had worked on Biden's very first presidential campaign. He had worked in his Senate office. The two men had been friends for a very long time. And Tom Udall's father had actually been Interior Secretary decades before. And it was sort of seen as, well, this is kind of a natural fit. And so and there were a couple of other candidates as well. Deb Haaland was not one of them. In the middle of this, this campaign started up among Native American and tribal and environmental activists who decided to make the case, look, this is a moment to have a Native American at the head of the agency, the government agency that has more power than any other government agency over the lives of Native Americans. And this campaign started probably about last August, saying, look, we have this congresswoman, this Native American congresswoman who is from a Western state that is very, you know, has a lot of public lands. She's on the House Natural Resources Committee. She works on these issues. She's passionate and experienced in environmental policy. And they kind of started this campaign to elevate and kind of get her in the mix without even actually talking to her. And as it turned out, we found out later that as this campaign sort of pushed the Biden campaign and then the transition to bring her into the mix, she wasn't even aware and she wasn't initially even a part of it, but eventually sort of came along and said, well, yes, I could do that. And then the campaign, you know, after the election really gained steam. And as the as President Biden started putting together his cabinet, we saw in his deliberations, it became clear that he explicitly wanted to create the most diverse cabinet that the U.S. had seen. He wanted it to be representative. He wanted to have historic appointments. And so and the pressure was just coming sort of increasing. So into that moment, it just kind of became, you know, within the transition, it was a deliberation, but it was sort of this moment of, well, this could be a historic nominee. Even though there was opposition by Republicans, they went ahead, and that was how that choice was made.
Well, ultimately, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican, sealed the deal for Haaland's confirmation.
I have really struggled through this one, how to reconcile an historic nomination with my concerns about an individual's and an administration's conception of what Alaska's future should be. I truly believe that Representative Haaland's heart is there for Native peoples and all who treasure our public lands. I don't believe that is the extent of Interior's mission, but she's also told us that she recognizes that if confirmed, she'll be serving in a different capacity.
Carl, some of the Republican senators who did not support Haaland's nomination come from states with large Native populations, too, like Murkowski. What is the political calculation they're making?
Well, you know, I can tell you that the political calculation that Lisa Murkowski appeared to make is kind of weighing the extremely important role that oil and gas development plays in her state's economy versus the fact that 18% of her state is Native Alaskan. And so that is clearly a very significant portion of her electorate. And that's a larger percentage than in some of those other states. And I think but ultimately that was kind of what seemed to make the biggest impact. And part of that, again, is getting that back to that same campaign, these Native tribal and environmental and progressive activists that pushed Deb Haaland onto the scene, helped secure that nomination in the first place, have not stopped. And, you know, a lot of people I've talked to have said, we have not seen something like this, where essentially this campaign is going out into the states that have a significant portion of Native Americans as part of the electorate, and making sure that the Natives, because Natives aren't necessarily a guaranteed Democratic vote, and saying, you know, wanting to hold these senators to account and saying, if you do not vote to support the first Native cabinet secretary, we will vote against you. Mm-hmm. That message seemed to resonate with Senator Murkowski. We'll see what happens with a lot of these other Republican senators who are clearly no votes.
What do we know about Biden's larger policy agenda when it comes to the Department of the Interior?
So the most controversial one is that he has proposed to end new oil and gas leases on public lands. That's a really big deal. And if that actually comes to pass, that will be a dramatic change for the way in which public lands are used in America.
That's Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for The New York Times. Coral, thanks for speaking with us.
It's great to be with you.
Ordinary Dame tweeted, "It's about time to listen to and follow indigenous leadership that treats the land with respect and love." Up next, we'll talk to Robin Wall Kimmerer about how our relationship with public lands might be changing.
Support for 1A and the following message come from The Jab, a new podcast from The Economist. How well will COVID-19 vaccines work, and what do they mean for life going forward? What are vaccine passports, and will you need one? Find the answers in The Jab. Each week, The Economist science correspondent Alok Jha and their health policy editor Natasha Loader unpack a different theme and talk through the race between infections and injections. Subscribe and listen to The Jab for free today on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or your podcast app.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we help you make sense of one big story in the news every day, like how to combat disinformation and conspiracy theories, which pose a real threat to democracy, and what life looks like after you're vaccinated, the next phase of do's and don'ts. All that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
We're discussing Congresswoman Deb Haaland's historic nomination to lead the Department of the Interior and what it could mean to have an American Indian in charge of public lands. She would oversee nearly one-fifth of land in the U.S. through the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And Haaland would be the first indigenous person to manage two of the agencies that most directly affect Native Americans across the country, the Bureaus of Indian Affairs and Indian Education. Joining us to talk about what this all means are Robin Wall Kimmerer, the director of the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. She's also the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. And she's an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm honored to join you.
Also with us, Katrina Phillips, an assistant professor of American and Native American history at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's also a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Katie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Katie, what does it mean to you to have an Indigenous woman nominated as a cabinet secretary?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the history of the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and you look at this really long history of federal Indian policy, I think it's really a testament to not only, you know, the survival of Native peoples, but also, you know, what it means to see a Native woman in this position, right? To have, you know, to see Native nations overcome so much over, you know, these last couple hundred years, that to have her in that position really demonstrates also, you know, what I hope is the Biden administration's goal of understanding the importance of Native issues.
Robin, your thoughts?
I have to say I'm totally elated by the prospects of a Native woman in Interior, certainly for its historic and symbolic value and for what it will mean for the land, for its ecological significance, and, as Katie says, its impact on Indigenous nations. I know that I am not alone in having shed some very happy tears over this nomination. And to think that the federal agency that oversaw the taking of Indigenous lands and oppressed Native peoples would now be under the stewardship of a Native woman. Yeah, the question of resilience that Katie brings up, to me, it opens the doors for healing for land and for people. It gives me a hope for justice.
Katie, there are a few agencies within the Department of the Interior we'll talk about today, but I want to start with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Bureau of Indian Education. What's the important history we should know about the Department of Interior's relationship with tribal nations?
So Indian affairs were actually first governed by the Continental Congress. And so in 1775, they created a Committee on Indian Affairs, which was actually headed by Benjamin Franklin. And, you know, it's also outlined in the Constitution, you know, Article 1, Section 8. It's known as the Commerce Clause. It highlights, you know, Congress's power over Indian affairs. And it says to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And so they create, you know, the Bureau in 1824 to oversee and carry out governmental trade and treaty relations with Native nations. And what's interesting is that Indian Affairs was actually initially in the War Department. And so it was moved to the Department of the Interior in 1849 when the Interior was created. And, you know, it's really incredible because Indian Affairs is almost as old as the United States itself, and its role and its responsibilities have changed over the years, especially as federal Indian policy has changed and shifted. And so now it oversees the 574 federally recognized nations, and it provides services, you know, whether directly or through contracts, for everything from, you know, disaster relief and child welfare to the management of trust lands and, you know, carrying out the BIA's mission at the tribal level.
Can you give us a couple of examples of early policies that came out of that bureau?
Sure. So I think when we, you know, if we're kind of looking at the history of federal Indian policy, you know, I think the term that most people use is kind of coexistence, kind of uneasy coexistence in a lot of instances. But when we get into, you know, kind of the 1820s, 1830s, that's when we get into the policy of Indian removal. And it's codified with the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And, you know, I think when you look at the history of federal Indian policy and the role of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it makes sense why, well, there are a couple things that make sense. One is that, you know, a lot of Native people don't necessarily trust the federal government, don't necessarily believe that the government is going to have our best interests in mind. And when you look at not only the Removal Act of 1830, but then another key piece of legislation is the General Allotment Act of 1887, which is also known as the Dawes Act. And it ended up leading to the loss of more than two-thirds of tribally entrusted lands. And so Native nations went from holding 138 million acres of land in 1871 to 48 million acres in 1934. And so that's, you know, when we look at, and I know I keep saying, you know, we're looking at this really long history, but thinking about what Robin said, you know, about the, not only the resilience again, but, you know, just being so kind of taken back by what it means to have Deb Haaland in this role, I think there's so much history that helps explain why her nomination means so much to so many people.
Robin, you know, when I think about the role of people who are the first, there's the symbolism of that moment, and then there is the reality of what it means for them to take that position. How impactful do you think Haaland's role as Secretary of the Interior can have in shifting the relationship between Native governments and the U.S. government?
Because she has lived and her ancestors, as all of our ancestors, have lived these shifting federal policies that led to dispossession of land. And it also led to an imposition of a foreign way of thinking about what land means, you know, that land shifted from our sacred homelands to the property of someone else. I think that because she is part of that legacy, she has and accepts that responsibility for the healing of that, I think she will stand up for the government-to-government relationships that are have been mandated in policy, but over the last 4 years largely ignored. I think that there will come a time when, you know, when you think about public lands as being the legacy of we the people, well, we the people has not always included Native voices. There are, especially in our very own homelands. And I think that she will be a good listener. I think the door is open for Native people to have the voice that they should have. You know, there's this policy, federal policy, of this duty to consult with the tribes, and that's all well and good. But more often than not, that duty to consult is done in a very pro forma way. It's a duty to consult, which means you're invited to the table to say your piece, but no one actually has to listen or consider what you have requested and brought to that debate. I think the respectful dialogue over the meaning of land and the management of land can now have Indigenous philosophy and science helping to inform it.
Katie, what do you think Holland should focus on when it comes to relationships with tribal nations?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the first thing that comes to mind is, again, as Robin says, restoring that nation-to-nation relationship. And I think, you know, there's a quote from Will Rogers that I use probably more often than I should, but I think it kind of perfectly encapsulates this relationship. And so Will Rogers once said, "Every time the Indians move, the government will give them a treaty. They say, 'You can have this ground as long as the grass grows and water flows.' Now they have moved the Indians, and they settled the whole thing by putting them on land where the grass won't grow and the water won't flow." And I think not only in terms of kind of getting that nation-to-nation relationship back, but also understanding what Native nations need and what Native nations want as far as tribal economies and self-determination and self-governance. You know, a lot of federal policies, you know, throughout the 20th century were really aimed at undermining Native sovereignty. And we still see it now. I mean, there are still court cases and all these attempts to just kind of slowly by slowly eat away at the foundation of sovereignty. And I think, you know, with the economy, with tribal lands and governance and things like that, I think, I mean, every person you talk to is going to have a different answer. I mean, you could bring 15 Native historians on and we would probably give you 15 different answers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think those are probably the top ones, at least from my understanding.
Robin, I'm thinking about the quote Katie just shared with us from Will Rogers, and looking at this message we got from Matt on Facebook, who says, "How do you encourage wisdom and wisdom traditions in a culture that seems, at least in the mainstream, antithetical to such?" Your thoughts?
I think that for too long, the contributions of the Indigenous worldview of how we might live in right relationship to the land and to one another has been largely marginalized and indeed attempted to be erased. And so one of the most important things we can do is to elevate and educate those ways of knowing. These ways of knowing that, you know, sometimes are dismissed, they had been dismissed as folklore, but they are in fact sophisticated indigenous land management science and philosophies and practices that embody this wisdom that your listener is talking about. So bringing those ways of relating to the land into education, into the next generation of education, educating natural resource managers and environmental professionals, for example, is going to be hugely important so that the land can benefit and the people can benefit.
We're discussing public lands in the Department of the Interior. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Neuroscientist Kimberly Noble wants to know, if a family gets more money,
does it directly impact children's cognitive development?
Ideas about the brain. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
We're discussing public lands and the Department of the Interior and what Congresswoman Deb Haaland's historic nomination to lead the department could mean. During her confirmation hearing, Haaland tried to walk a pretty thin line when it comes to energy development on public lands.
There's no question that fossil energy does and will continue to play a major role in America for years to come. I know how important oil and gas revenues are to critical services. But we must also recognize that the energy industry is innovating, and our climate challenge must be addressed. Together, we can work to position our nation and all of its people for success in the future. And I am committed to working cooperatively with all stakeholders and all of Congress to strike the right balance going forward.
Robin, how do you think about this balance she has to strike between energy independence and sustainable resource management, especially when there are some Native tribes that profit from fossil fuels?
Well, certainly, and it's going to be a really tough balancing act. On behalf of climate, we think about the ways in which public lands do contribute to excess carbon in the atmosphere, right, to climate change. But one of the things that I think she has in her power in this balancing, Jen, is that it's not only a matter of putting pause on new extraction, but that the public lands can be part of a regenerative economy that also addresses climate change by the input from the fossil fuel industry, but by the way that natural ecosystems can absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. When you think about this, these, you know, 480 million acres of public land, the vegetation on those places can be part of the natural climate solution, natural solutions that climate modelers talk about in terms of drawdown of carbon by woodlands, by wetlands, and indeed by grasslands, if managed in an innovative rotational grazing, can actually sequester carbon. So I think she has the opportunity to balance the climate change and fossil fuels questions by both supporting the natural processes of carbon sequestration in vegetation, as well as by beginning the just transition away from fossil fuels. As given her background, we know that local land-based economies are essential in the West and indeed throughout the country. But in addition to, or really eventually, instead of extractive economies, what about interior leading the way for restoration-based economies, recreation-based economies that really lift up ecological integrity on the lands? And I think that's part of the balance.
Katie, your thoughts, especially with that added complication of the fact that there are native tribes that do benefit from the fossil fuel industry?
Well, I mean, there's no easy answer here. I'm in Minnesota, and the protests over Line 3 are kind of dominating, at least, the news here right now.
But can you give us a little background on that?
Sure. So Line 3 is a pipeline up here that's, I believe the current path goes through Ojibwe treaty lands, and there are a lot of concerns about not only, the treaty lands themselves, but also the potential for spills into a lot of really important water that, and, being that far north, it has the potential to really have disastrous impacts if a spill were to occur. And so there are, that's in the news a lot here in Minnesota lately. But I mean, I keep coming back again to that Will Rogers quote I said earlier, for the native nations who are on land where grass doesn't grow and water doesn't flow. I mean, for the three affiliated tribes at the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota, their tribal chairman said recently that 80 to 85% of the tribe's budget comes from oil and gas royalties and taxation. And, at the end of January, the Department of the Interior exempted them from a temporary suspension of oil and gas leasing and permitting on federal and tribal lands. And, there are a lot of people that likely don't like Indian gaming for whatever reasons, whether it's moral reasons or, how much money Native nations can make from casinos. But gaming, like oil and gas, are also the foundations of many tribal economies. And so I, listening to Robin talk about these kind of restorative dreams, right, for economies and for the lands and things like that, I think if Deb Haaland were confirmed, I mean, I don't believe that this would kind of be, a blanket appointment, right? Mm-hmm. I think understanding the nuances that every Native nation has a different foundation for their economy. They have a different, I don't want to say relationship with public lands and with our treaty lands, but I think understanding all of those little nuances is one of the things that I'm actually really excited about with her nomination, is that, she's going to be able to look at Native nations here in Minnesota and look at tribes in the Southwest and the Pacific Northwest and realize that they're all going to need and going to want different things.
When a lot of people think of the Department of Interior, they think national parks. And Katie, two national monuments, a different designation than a national park in southern Utah, became flashpoints in the conversation around federal lands and conservation recently. President Trump significantly reduced Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. President Biden has made moves to restore them. Why was the fight over these monuments so significant?
Well, I think, when we're talking about Bears Ears, it contains, like so many of these places, it has historic and cultural and natural resources. And the fact that it's co-managed by the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service, along with five local tribes, I think really kind of helps shape why these are so important, right? Because a lot of people care about and have relationships with public lands. And for something like Bears Ears, where that push to protect it is coming from multiple stakeholders, when it's coming from both, when you have it coming from environmental activists and conservationists and Native nations, right? I mean, I think one thing that I keep coming back to, and I think Robin speaks to this really well, you know, a lot of these stakeholders have similar goals. And I think, you know, kind of the push to separate and kind of even pit environmentalists and conservationists against Native nations is part of this larger struggle. I mean, Native lands were never pristine or untouched, right? I mean, Robin writes so beautifully about how Native people use land and use the materials on the land that when we look at something like bear's ears and what it means to protect it, it's just, I mean, I think it's a really critical turning point in understanding why these monuments mean so much to so many people.
Leanne emailed, I'm a 63-year-old woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Our family has undocumented tribal membership, though I was gifted an honorary Cherokee flag at my mother's memorial service. This nomination is indescribable. It's not only historic and all that can be said there, it's a bringing in and calling out to the ancestors to have our place in our government. And Dara shares this story. I interned at Interior in Washington, D.C. for a year during law school, studying federal Indian law. I'm a citizen of the Diné Nation. The hallway outside of the secretary's office is lined with portraits of every secretary of interior since 1849, mostly white men and two women. Many of those men have been in charge of the Indian problem, calling out genocidal policies such as the Long Walk and the Trail of Tears to clear land for white settlers. As an indigenous woman, having an indigenous woman as secretary of interior is truly an end to the murderous land theft policies that the U.S. has promulgated. Robin, one of the biggest challenges any cabinet secretary is facing is climate change. What role would you like to see Holland play in managing that crisis?
Again, I would return to the role of public lands. When you think about the ways that public lands can really be a part of the tipping point of the United States strategy in dealing with climate change, both in the fossil fuel question and in, again, managing those lands in such a way that they support biodiversity and climate change sequestration. There's so much good science out there showing the way that managed land, in particular, sometimes using the indigenous strategies for land management, can actually help regulate climate by taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and supporting biodiversity. You know, climate change, we are on the brink of the climate change catastrophe, but we're also in the midst of what's been called the age of the sixth extinction and accelerating biodiversity loss. These things are connected to each other, right? Because climate change is the driver of that biodiversity loss. And I think that she can play a pivotal role in both of those efforts. Hmm.
Well, your book, Braiding Sweetgrass, is all about how we interact with the natural world. How do you hope people might learn to have a different relationship with public lands?
You know, I was really struck by Katie's comment when we were talking about the bear's ears, about the way that the bear's ears, for example, is a model of people interacting with land. It's not like the velvet rope idea about land as being, you know, preserved over there without human interaction. It's the notion that people are part of a cultural and ecological landscape. And that's part of the genius of indigenous land management sciences, is to understand that people, the way I think of it, people can be medicine for the land. We don't just have to be takers. We can be givers through our land management practices. It's an invitation to be part of land as if you belonged there. And, you know, I think about so much of the history and the Western industrial kind of worldview about land has treated land as if it was a source of belongings. And it is. The land cares for us and sustains us with everything that we need, right? But land is more than belongings. I think it can be our most profound source of belonging. And I think that Deb Haaland has an amazing opportunity here, you know, especially given thinking about the tremendous polarity that we are experiencing in this country, that we're looking for common ground. And what could be more common than the ground beneath our feet, right? I think she has an opportunity to unite disparate interests around the national treasure that is public land.
That was Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's the director of the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment and a professor of environmental biology at the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. She's also the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, and an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. Also with us, Katrina Phillips, an assistant professor of American and Native American History at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she's a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Ojibwe. Katrina, Robin, thanks to you both. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White.